talking today with Dr. Brett Carver, of course, wheat breeder out of Oklahoma State University. Brett, it was very interesting to me that in your presentation today here to the Grain Feed Association, it took you all the way to your last slide to actually show some of the things going on with wheat breeding program right now. There's a lot of things happening in the wheat industry that you're paying attention to right now beyond just your wheat breeding duties.
Oh, yes. We have to have our eyes wide open. And what's going on out there, and we've talked about this many times before, the tremendous investment in wheat improvement in the public sector and in the private sector especially that is making, I think, this a very attractive industry. In the United States compared to other places of the world. So I'm really excited about what's going on, but I'm also keeping my eyes wide open.
I know that you mentioned, obviously there's several companies that are involved right now. Monsanto was one of the early ones that stepped in, stepped out, now they're getting back in. But the ones you mentioned to me that was really interesting was Bayer. You said that they really have kind of stepped up.
Yeah, Bayer didn't really have anything as far as a wheat improvement program. In fact, nothing that I knew of. And the way that they were able to enter that picture was to quickly work with, through licensing or cooperative agreements with universities, or just basically purchase breeding programs. And they did both. And now Bayer is a very impressive force in the landscape for wheat improvement. I didn't mention this in my presentation today, but you will hear about lines that they have been able to work an arrangement with, say, the University of Nebraska to put in our regional trials. You will see Bayer lines actually in the regional trials that we all participate in that last year were not there.
Now, you mentioned they had actually purchased a couple of companies from the Ukraine. What's the significance of that for us, you think?
Well, in terms of numbers, it's probably not that significant, but where the acquisition took place does raise my eyebrow a little bit. Because Eastern Europe is an area that we depend upon heavily, and not just us, but other breeding programs throughout the Great Plains depend on heavily to bring in new germplasm, whether it's for disease resistance or other agronomic traits. In fact, Oklahoma State University just recently signed an MTA, a material transfer agreement, with two organizations, one in Hungary and one in Romania, to ensure the future access of germplasm in those parts of the world. And fortunately, those organizations have not signed on to an agreement with a private company that might limit their ability to operate and cooperate with us. But as we see more and more of those kinds of acquisitions, I do get a little bit nervous about that. Germplasm access is so important to what we do.
That really is maybe the key as far as the future of the public breeding program, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think we had the talent to use it, but if we can't get to it and use it or access it, then we're going to be, our hands will be tied behind our backs.
Let's talk a little bit about, before we go back to the OSU program, let's talk a little bit about the wheat berry situation and our wheat belly situation and the situation with gluten. Seems like there's one man that has really almost led the charge. It's this William Davis.
Yeah, he was the one that really got it going. But there have been others to join in, and they're in the medical world, which gives them the lends the impression that they know what they're talking about. But in this case, they don't have all the facts, and if they have some facts, they twist them around to simply instill fear and to cause shock and just basically get attention. And in William Davis's perspective, sell more books, because he does have a book out there that is quite popular on this concept of the wheat belly. You know, wheat is not good for you. You shouldn't be eating it. We should be eating other forms of foods for our energy. But it's not just William Davis anymore. I think that message has spread it's spread like wildfire, actually.
And it really, it's an assault in a lot of ways on the wheat breeding programs that you're involved with and your predecessors.
Yeah, the assault comes in the form of misinformation, statements that we are using steps and using procedures in wheat breeding that don't really drive a typical public wheat breeding program. Again, if you just bring out the word mutation, it just has a negative connotation to it. And so if you start saying, well, breeding programs rely on mutations and mutagenic agents and chemical-inducing mutations, these are all concepts that get people fired up. But they're not true. And yes, we have used chemicals to induce mutations, but a very low degree. And I pointed out one, in fact. But just because you're using those chemical mutagens to cause a mutation, you're not ingesting or not consuming the mutagenic agent. And that's where we have to be able to separate the two. And I'm not sure that that's right. That's right. They want to connect the two.
Right. Now, specifically, he talks about that somehow you've manipulated the gluten, the wheat protein, compared to, say, 40 or 50 years ago, and it's radically different.
Right. And we have modified that protein to the extent of making it more conducive to, say, a commercial high-speed baking operations. But just because you make those changes do not necessarily say you make changes in the way your body can digest it. There have been just a limited number of studies that look specifically at the types of protein that have changed over time and whether or not our body can digest those proteins any differently. From what I've seen, there really is no convincing evidence that those proteins have changed in that way. Yes, we have made dough stronger. Yes, we have made a dough more extensible, but we made it less digestible. Not necessarily. We do need the research to confirm that.
Right. Finally, in your breeding program at OSU, a couple things got stuck on that one slide that you did have. Drought resistance and also next generation duster.
Well, you know, the 2011 year, and of course we had some other years before that, but the 2011 year was a misery to a lot of us, but it did offer us an opportunity to select and put a lot of pressure on drought resistance in our program. When no doubt about it, we had it, but we needed the environment to select for it, and that environment 2011 really gave us that chance. So there are definitely some drought-resistant forms in our program that we might have thrown away. We're latching onto those, hanging on to them, and we're going to use them either directly or indirectly in the program.
What about this next generation duster? What do you foresee there?
Yeah, I'm really excited about taking the next generation of duster on, and I think we can improve duster in several ways. One that comes to mind is, and we've heard a lot about the leaf spotting this year. If we can correct that situation in Negrillo, I think we're going to be better off. If we can just increase kernel size, I think the millers would like to see a larger kernel from duster. The two new varieties, Gallagher and Iva, definitely increase kernel size without sacrificing tiller numbers. And that's how I think we're getting the higher yield in those new varieties. We're simply increasing the kernel size. So you're going to hear more about the next generation of duster. We have to be careful about that, though, because I'm a big fan of diversity. You know, I talk all the time about how our two most common varieties in Oklahoma, duster and endurance, are worlds apart in their genetic lineage. And I think that's very important as far as how we deal with climate change, how we deal with whatever nature is going to give to us.
Right.
So I'm a little bit careful about just relying strictly on duster and perpetuating that lineage throughout our program. We'll take advantage of it, but very responsibly.
How do you intend, or how do you foresee genetically modified GM type wheat in your breeding program?
I see opportunities every day. When we see a gene that works fairly well, and I can give you a specific example through the media, and that's a gene we call LR34, and I've talked about this at field days quite a bit. Duster is a variety that contains this gene. The gene by itself doesn't work very well, but when you combine it with other genes, it gives us a very effective level of resistance to, say, leaf rust, and duster definitely has that. Not so much to stripe rust, but more to leaf rust. But this is a gene that if we could somehow modify it, and there are others out there, but if we could modify it so that it's a more efficient gene or it's expressed at a higher level, I think we would go a long ways to improving the overall leaf health of wheat and its ability to tolerate these diseases. And it's a very, acceptable approach to the public. You're just taking a gene that's already there, mm-hmm. and making it work better, to put it in very simple terms.
Dr. Brett Carver, wheat breeder at Oklahoma State University, talking with us about a variety of things, including the business of breeding wheat, as well as his concerns about wheat belly, and a look at some of the things going on within the OSU wheat breeding program. On the Oklahoma Farm Report, I'm Ron Hayes.